We're talking about the five operas in this season of the Santa Fe Opera, and our guest today is Desiree Mays, international opera lecturer and storyteller, and author of the book Opera Unveiled, now in its 17th year. She speaks every night at the Preview Buffet at the Opera. Welcome, Desiree, to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte.
We're talking today about the opera Daughter of the Regiment. And Desiree, how do you pronounce that in French?
La fille du régiment.
La fille du régiment.
That's the way it's usually described, actually. It's unusual to call it the daughter of the regiment, but one doesn't need a lot of French to make the transition.
Right, right. So, and it's by Gaetano Donizetti. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, every Donizetti opera that I've seen at the Santa Fe Opera is not only hilarious, charming, but they're very well and creatively staged. They're just a delight to go to.
They are, yeah. And they're usually fun and up and crazy, with the exception perhaps of Lucia di Lammermoor, which is also by Donizetti. That surprises some people sometimes because they think of him as a light, fun composer, but actually that's a pretty serious opera.
Right.
This one, however, is pure fun and nonsense. It's a great piece. It's actually a French-style Donizetti. He had a great career in Italy, of course. That's where he started and made his name. And when he brought Lucia di Lammermoor to Paris, they loved him so much they invited him to come and stay. So he did. And when he arrived in Paris, this was his first and really his I don't know about only, but best French opera. It started with the title, you know, La Fille du Régiment. French piece, not an Italian piece. So here there's a wonderful blend. The style is a little different. It's not typical Donizetti, though it has all those wonderful flowing melodies that we love him for. The main difference, I suppose, was that the commission came from the Opéra Comique in Paris, where in that theater there had to be a fair amount of dialogue between the songs. So a little differently to the Italian, in the Italian style, they would have the recitative, which would be a little short bit that got into the songs. In the French version, there's quite a lot of chat, talk, and then they sing, rather like a musical, the way we expect musicals to be. You follow the story in the speaking parts. And the way we're getting in dealing with that here in Santa Fe again this year, and it's been very effective, is because no one's going to understand the French well enough in the dialogue. The dialogue will be in English, but the musical numbers will all be in the original French. And it sounds odd, but actually it flows beautifully.
And I suppose if your opera singers are American or native English speakers and there's going to be spoken dialogue, I mean, it's one thing to sing in French, but it's another thing to try to do dialogue like
Absolutely.
Theater in French. Yeah. That would be hard.
Yeah, a few more thousands of dollars spent on coaches in order to make it work. So this is a nice compromise that has worked well with this company, and we'll be doing it in the Daughter of the Regiment. So
this is set in, well, let's see, it premiered in Paris in 1840. That was where the commission was. Where was it originally
the
set?
The setting?
Yeah.
And we're doing this in the original setting, too, which people will be happy about, I know. The original setting is around 1800, at the time of the Napoleonic Wars. And the army that's involved here, the regiment, is the 21st Regiment of Napoleon, who are fighting in the Austrian Tyrol. So the setting is in the Tyrol, in the mountains, which is sort of Sound of Music country. Very beautiful setting. There's no war involved, even though we are dealing with an army here, and there's a lot of, you know, rousing marches. But that's the setting, and the costumes will be appropriate to that period as well. So the whole thing is done as it was intended to be done by Donizetti. I suppose you could change this, but the setting is perfect. Why change it? It all stems around this, the daughter of the regiment, who is Marie. Marie became beloved by French audiences because they all took her to their hearts. She was a foundling who was found on a battlefield, totally unrealistic.
Unlikely, yeah. This is not the world's most realistic opera, any of them are.
No, but this one is certainly not. And this regiment takes her in and rears her. So she has a regiment of fathers. She calls them all fathers, particularly Sulpice, who is the older soldier there. He's her main father. The others all raise her, and she becomes the vivandière. She's the flag bearer. She does the washing, peels the potatoes, irons, their clothes, all of these things. And she's their mascot, I suppose. So they love her as such. And she became one of the great characters beloved by French audiences through that time. In fact, this opera was played every year on Bastille Day for many, many years after the premiere, because it seemed to epitomize what French nationalism was all about.
And she's quite a little tomboy.
Yeah,
well, absolutely. She's a grown-up, but I mean, she's
Oh, she's a tomboy. She is. Yeah. I mean, she dresses like a boy. She speaks and swears like a boy, and because she's never been around female company, you know, and that's all about to change.
That's all about to change in this opera.
But the first person we meet in the opera is actually a marchesa, who is the local grande dame of the community, and she's a little put out because there's this invading army, and it doesn't suit her plans. The French are invading her village, and the villagers are all running to her. What do we do? What do we do? She says, we'll pray to the Virgin, and it's very inconvenient of the French to invade. So, so that's a sort of the tone of the thing. That's the first cut I've got for you today, actually. Let's hear a little of the Marchesa at the very beginning of the daughter of the regiment, wondering how they should all prepare for the arrival of the enemy, the French.
Music of Donizetti, the daughter of the regiment, and that was the Marchesa or the Marquise singing that the French are coming, and of course the French are our enemy. Beloved, they're the enemy, but
yes.
To us, the opera audience, they're the regiment who has found and raised this lovely daughter.
That's true. Everybody else is an Austrian.
And they're Austrian. So the Marquise is Austrian.
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
I should mention perhaps right up front, Marishana, that the recording I'm using today is really a spectacular recording. The conductor is Richard Bonning, and the Marie is Joan Sutherland. This was one of her great roles. And Luciano Pavarotti is the tenor Tonio. And apparently Joan Sutherland, it was early in his career, trained him for some of the great technique that he had in the course of this opera. And the benefit of it is all, of course, in this piece. Well, now Marie enters. She comes rushing on stage and gets herself busy. And she talks with Sulpice, who is her main father, I suppose, and she's happy. She loves her life with the regiment, and that's expressed in this opening song. And she also explains to him that she's met someone on a hike in the forest.
She met a boy.
She did. And the story is, totally implausibly also, that she was about to fall over a cliff and he rescued her. Well, this is one sure-footed lady. It's very
exactly.
unlikely, but they fell into one another's arms. But technically, he is the enemy because he is an Austrian. But she's telling Sulpice about this. So let's hear a little of her wonderfully exuberant entrance, which is this sort of marching sound of the regiment.
Thank you.
And thus sang Marie.
The tomboy at the beginning of this opera.
She doesn't sound like a tomboy.
No, wait till you see her, though. And anyone who saw the incredible HD screening from the Met with Natalie Dessay and Juan Diego Flores, they have become the two greatest interpreters of this role. She's there in a sort of a little undershirt, and she's ironing their clothes. It's a marvelous scene.
And she says, life is grand. I love you all.
Yes, yes.
Everything is great, and I met a boy.
Yeah, that's right. She's beginning to get into the story.
And they're not jealous because they're all her fathers, even though they're probably the same age as she is. But we don't think about that because
exactly.
It's opera.
Well, some of them would probably like to be her husband, but she's not interested in any of them. I should mention here, because we just had a little touch of it, this is what we call a bel canto role. The singer who sings this has to be at the center of everything. She has to be sparkling, an incredible actress, and able to handle the vocal technique with all these runs and trills. And it's not that she can just sing them. They have to be very beautifully sung. So each note has to be almost caressed, and the way it's presented, or sparkling, as you heard here a little bit. We'll hear a little more as we go through these excerpts. But that's a sense of Marie when she comes in. And this leads then into the rataplan chorus. The rataplan is the mimicking of the drums, the little drums that would send the soldiers off to war. I mean, there's this whole business of the glory of going to war and the parties and the marches that sent people off to these terrible wars. You know, it's right.
And this is one of those operas. I mean, and we have, Lord knows, not only opera, but every other art form, talking about the horrors of war and the gravitas of war. And in this war opera, there's really no war at all.
There's no war at all. No, we never hear them about their fighting or what goes on. We hear a little bit in terms of Tonio, but there is no blood and thunder in this. It's pure fun, this opera. So let's hear a little of the Rataplan chorus.
We're talking about and listening to music from The Daughter of the Regiment, which is the opera by Gaetano Donizetti. And it's interesting. I mean, he's an Italian, obviously, who got a commission to do this piece in Paris. Now, were all opera composers, just by the nature of their education and training, able to compose in different languages? I mean, certainly some of them did. I mean, Mozart did, etc.
Right. And Mozart was bilingual, of course, but many of the others were maybe not. The Italians probably, Italian was their language, the French was French, but at this time, the great bel canto composers, Rossini and Donizetti and Bellini, all arrived in Paris. This is where they had the major part or main part of their careers, because Paris was the center of the world for grand opera. You had sort of variety of stars in Paris, and everybody flocked to Paris to see opera. It was grand opera at the great opera, the great theatre. There was opera comique, which is what we're dealing with today, which is this lighter style, a sort of a comic opera, if you like. And then if there were Italian operas that were presented in Paris, they'd be presented in the Théâtre Italien. The way they would work around this, because the singers came from all over, of course, they spoke many different languages, though mainly European languages. They would have been French, German, Italian singers, not so many English and certainly not what happens now, where you get singers from Latvia and Russia and China. I mean, the language is extraordinary, but these people do tend to speak, they all speak English. So take Richard Strauss, for instance. When he heard Salome, he couldn't understand it in its original French, so it was translated, and he worked from the German translation. I understand that rehearsals in those days, and even today, can be great fun, Mary Charlotte, because you go into rehearsal, and the singers, the director, the conductor, are all from different countries, and the rehearsals happen in multi-languages. It's very exciting.
Wow.
Yeah, and they all get it. I mean, you can go in, and and sometimes the director will switch into two or three different languages to make his point so that the singers get it, because some singers speak very little English, and vice versa. You know, it's fun. It gives an edge to the whole thing, and they all understand what they're on about. I find it's a bit actually like going to a yoga class. I go to a yoga class in all different countries where the instructor has another language. I've been to four or five different countries where I don't speak a word of the instructor's language, but we totally understand each other, and it's
because well, you already know the moves.
You know the moves, but even still, you know, they know the music and the interpretation. So today, however, singers are expected to be able to handle fairly competently a number of languages. I once interviewed a Carmen. I'll never forget this. I forget where she was from. She wasn't Spanish, certainly, or French, or any of the language you would have expected. And she had no idea what Don Jose was singing to her. So she's singing a love duet, and he's singing back to her. And she hasn't, at those days, you know, you didn't have to know what the other characters were on about. How can you do a love duet without knowing what they're saying?
And did it work?
Yeah, she was good enough, you know, to carry it off, but it might have been better if she had known. And I think that must be a problem with Russian singers too. I mean, none of our young singers, American, English speaking, really have a natural feel for Russian. And to be able to go into the depth that they have to understand not just the language, but the nuances. I have such respect for someone like Patricia Rasset, who's such a popular singer here. When she sings Katia Karbanova, Janáček, she's singing Czech. The real thing, she gets it, she understands it. So it's it's an interesting phenomenon that how they manage to make this work. If you ever have a chance to sit in on a rehearsal, not the final dress, because then there's not much going on in terms of this type of discussion, but the early rehearsals, you can often see this, and it's magical.
This is one thing that I want to ask you, and we talk about this often when we do these opera conversations, but it's important to think about, I think, when you're going behind the scenes, even if only in your mind. You've got a director of the opera and you've got a conductor of the orchestra, and they have to, on some level, be on the same page, but they've got different jobs. How do they work together?
That's a very good question. When I was a young person in Ireland starting out, it was the day of the conductor. You know, you'd said, oh, it's von Karajan's such and such, or whoever the conductor happened to be, because they were the central character in the whole thing. Before that, it had been the singers, or I'm going to hear Kallas sing such and such. And then it became the conductor's version. And now it's very much the director's version. I'm going to see Peter Sellers' version of such and such. I mean, that seems to be the way it is. And the director is the one who, in the early stages, works with the theater management, very often will either choose his own team or work with the general director in devising a concept for the piece. Are they going to do it in a traditional or non-traditional mode? And actually, the conductor doesn't seem to come on board until much later in the process, when a lot of these decisions have been made. So there has to be good rapport between the conductor, obviously, and the director, because they do come together in rehearsals. In fact, the conductor will very often either play the piano or be present for every rehearsal to understand what's going on and to talk about that type of interaction. But there's sort of a time thing. The director is the lead guy totally right up to the first performance, and then they disappear. They're gone.
Interesting.
And at that point, the conductor takes over. And actually, Mary Charlotte, from my point of view, the conductor is the one who, in performance, is holding it all together, because he's the one there in the pit who is directing the musicians. And these can be big orchestras and the singers on stage. He's the medium through which the entire thing happens.
Very, very interesting. I mean, it struck me a moment ago when you said when you were starting out in Ireland and you say, oh, this is von Karajan's opera. Well, I mean, one of the most famous conductors of all time. Do you still have that caliber of conductor conducting orchestra today?
Absolutely, yeah. Some of the great, great conductors love to conduct opera. It's a very special art form, but they seem to get a great thrill from it. There's people like James Conlon now in San Francisco, even Dudamel, who is the conductor of the LA orchestra there, is taking on concert versions of opera. They love to be in the center of that, and some of the greatest, Baron Bohm is another name that comes to mind. Our own Harry Bickett, who is the chief conductor here now in Santa Fe, we are so blessed to have this man. He's a Brit with a wife and a very young child, and he is he's most known for his Baroque interpretations. So it's wonderful to have him on board, and he will be conducting La Finta Giardiniera this year, the Mozart for us. But there has to be a good collaboration. Sometimes it really breaks down when this happens. The Met has been doing this. They take on directors who've directed Broadway shows with phenomenal success. Julie Taymor actually comes to mind, with phenomenal success, but without having the musical knowledge or background. So when it comes to trying to get the musical aspects across, they are sometimes at sea and sometimes totally at loggerheads with the conductor because they're not on the same page.
Now, are you talking about people who've directed Broadway theater or Broadway musical theater?
Yeah, Broadway musical theater.
So even though they have that kind of musical background, it's not opera, it doesn't...
Well, it's a step in the right direction, but it isn't as in-depth. Sometimes they're theater directors, but people like Jonathan Miller and certainly Peter Sellers know every bar of that score and know how they're going to interpret it and approach it, but that's not always the case. So that has to be got around, and that's a sort of a contemporary thing that's come into being. We have the most stunning directors, but there has to be that rapport, and sometimes when it comes down to it, depending on the production and the house, it's the director whose word goes.
Very, very interesting. And all of this is not necessarily visible to you listeners in Radio Land who are going to go see the opera. Mm-hmm. But I love thinking about this stuff.
Once you scratch the surface of opera, it's very rich. There's so many aspects to come to it. The conductor of The Daughter of the Regiment is Speranza Scappucci. So just from his name, that should be good for an Italian opera. He's a young Italian conductor, and it's his first time here. So
why don't we go back to talking about the actual opera? We're going to hear from the love interest, Tonio.
Absolutely, yes. Tonio has now shown up, and he's nabbed by the 21st Regiment because technically he is the enemy.
And if you're just tuning in, that's the boyfriend
of
the daughter.
Of Marie's, yes, yeah. So he and Marie have met and fallen in love, and they bring him on. He's their captive. She comes to his defense, and he says, I have only come because of Marie, and I am prepared to join up and enlist and become a member of the army in order to be near her. So this mollifies them a bit, and they let him go. And then he says, not only that, but we're in love, and I want to marry her. And this is the incredible aria that this opera is so well known for, the aria of the nine high seas. If the tenor can ace that, it's great. High seas. So you're going to hear all of those, one after the other. But again, it's that exuberance. This young man is in love. He is now going to be near his beloved, and he sings of that joy that you'll hear in this aria of the Nine High Seas. And in this recording, it is Luciano Pavarotti who really aced it. And we will have Alec Schrader sing here. He won fame when he did this in some television performance that he really brought everyone to their knees. It was so great the way he sang it. He sang here in our Albert Herring, and that was a sort of an overnight stardom move for him.
Okay.
And he has come back, and he looks the part, as does Anna Christie. These two are absolutely typecast visually in these two roles. So let's hear in this recording, Luciano Pavarotti sings Tonio's aria, A Mes Amis. Thank you.
and the note high C sung nine, count 'em nine times.
Times, yeah, exactly. It keeps coming back and back. And with Pavarotti, he handles it so beautifully. The sound is still full and open and totally in control and exuberant. This was an absolute showstopper at the Met in 2008, a few years ago, when Juan Diego Flores sang this aria. And he aced it so well. He was so on top of it and so exuberant that the audience went wild, and they applauded and applauded and applauded, and something happened that never happens at the Met. It used to be that any good aria would be repeated. There'd be an encore, so the opera would go on for hours.
Back in the old days.
Old days, yeah. 3-hour opera would become 4 hours because of the encores. Now it's banned. Nobody sings an encore. But in this instance, the only way to stop the audience from applauding was to allow Juan Diego Flores to sing it again.
Oh my God, that's such a throwback.
Yeah. And so, yes, it is. And such a thrill for the singer, apparently. Yeah. Alex Schrader said, you know, give them what they want, and if I do it well, I'm happy because I've made the audience happy. It's great.
We're talking about The Daughter of the Regiment by Gaetano Donizetti. Now, we are in our story so far. It's actually kind of cool because nothing scary or even particularly dramatic has even happened.
No, we got to the great aria, and you may not leave after the great aria because then the story actually does start.
Yeah,
to
now the
go
story
somewhere.
Begins.
Yes, it does. So then, after the great aria of the Nine High Seas, we get to meet some of the other characters, and they're developed a little further. The Marchesa, who is the grand dame of the village, speaks with Sulpice, who is one of the older soldiers, and they're talking about Captain Robert. Captain Robert had apparently had some connection with the Marchesa, and she listens to this, and she obviously triggers a memory for her, and then she says, oh, my sister was in love with Captain Robert, and they got married secretly and had a child, but it was tragic. He was killed in the war, and the child was lost, and Sulpice, of course, turns around and said, well, no, not lost. The
lost on the battlefield?
Lost
now, wait
on
a
the
minute.
Battlefield. Exactly. So this happens to be the same child. So the Marchesa says, oh, this is fantastic. I must meet her. And at that point, Marie comes bouncing on, and she's got a pretty blue mouth. And she's a real tomboy. And she says, who's that woman? And Sulpice says, this is your aunt. And then everything stops. And everyone realizes that she, Marie, is going to have to stop being a tomboy and become a lady and go with the Marchesa, who will take her under her wing and raise this niece, in quotes.
Is she young enough to still be raised?
Well, no, she's in her she's late teens. I mean, they're all in their late teens. Okay. But well, reared, I mean, transformed into the aristocrat that she's supposed to be. So this, for Marie, is terrible news. She loves the life she leads. She's in love with Tonio, and if she has to go and become a lady and he's going to fight the war, it's all falling apart. So the first act ends then with all of this semi-pseudo-tragic stuff where Marie has to go off with Marchesa, who's none too happy with this wild child that she's found. But she takes her in hand, and they get into this absolutely gorgeous golden carriage, which looks like the carriage out of one of the British coronations. And they wheel her off stage, and Sulpice and Tonio end up in tears in one another's arms. So that's the end of the first act. The second act then is where Marie is being groomed to be a lady, and she has the sort of required music lesson. All ladies of good family had to have music lessons, be able to play and sing, and she's got to sing this dreary song, Venus Ascending, which she's, you know, she's putting up with, but she's actually singing beautifully with all this bel canto. And Sulpice then appears out of nowhere. He comes in, and he starts humming the regimental march, and the two of them then start giggling, and they sing the regimental march, and the Marchesa goes off in a huff. After that, then, when everything settles down, Marie has a wonderful moment of introspection. Donizetti is so great with this. It's not all high fluff and wonderful, exuberant song. There are marvelous moments of introspection and reflection where Marie sings, and I'm going to play you a little of this. She sings, it's all settled. My life is about to be changed, and there's no one here to protect me. They have tried in vain to dazzle me with rank and luxury, and my grief I must keep to myself and live on memories. Beneath these jewels and lacy frills, I conceal a hopeless sorrow. What good is beauty to me when he alone cannot see me? So Aww. Let's hear a little of Marie's aria.
and music from the daughter of the regiment, and the daughter of the regiment is now the daughter or the niece, or actually we'll find out, the actual daughter of the aristocratic Marquesa. And, you know, this is, I mean, these are fairly mild problems to have as opera goes. It's like, oh, I'm the daughter of a loving military family, and now I'm going to be the daughter of an aristocrat. Yeah. Woe is me.
It's just a storyline to hang the music on.
Exactly.
You know, it's all about the music. But here the plot does thicken a little bit. Sulpice and the Marquesa are talking, and the Marquesa has decided to tell the truth to him. She tells him that, in fact, it wasn't her sister. It was she who had loved Captain Robert.
Why didn't she admit it?
Well, you couldn't admit, you know, an illegitimate child.
Oh, okay,
you know,
right.
Socially, this would have been.
Yeah,
she was already damned for having done it in the first place. And now, 20 years later, it's come up again. So she tells him about this. There's an interesting relationship here between Sulpice and the Marquesa that Ned Canty, the director, really wants to bring out. She's often caricatured as sort of the rather silly grand dame of the village. And in fact, he looked a little deeper into this and said, you know, this is a woman who is probably only in her early 40s. She had this baby when she was 20 or younger, and she could have another life. But because of what had happened to her, she's returned to her family. She's never been able to marry. And now she has second thought. She thinks, I'm going to take... She tells Sulpice the truth. She said, I'm not her aunt, I'm her mother. And Sulpice then relays this to Marie, who is ecstatic. She suddenly found a mother. But it's got a little tricky because in the course of time, the Marquesa has decided that Marie has to be married to the Duke of Krakenthorpe, and she doesn't the least want to do that. The Duchess of Krakenthorpe shows up. This is a speaking role usually done by a famous actress who throws her weight about saying, where is this woman that's going to marry my son?
I love that the Duchess is played, the mother of this Duke of Krakenthorpe, is played by a non-singing actress. Mm. So in the history of performance, there have been some amazing famous actors who weren't opera singers at all.
That's
who
right.
Got to be in an opera. It's kind of cool.
Yeah, who can come in and do this. So when the truth is out about the mother and daughter and they're being reunited and Marie is heartbroken because she doesn't want to sign the wedding contract. Here there's a little echo, actually, of Lucia de Lammermoor, I find. Donizetti at the time was transforming his Italian Lucia into Lucie de Lammermoor into a French version. And here is a young woman of good family who is being forced into a marriage she wants nothing to do with, as Marie is. She, not totally forced, but she, you know, it's expected of her to do this. So they all have a moment of truth here, and the Marquesa realizes that no, she is not going to do to her daughter what happened to her, to lead a lonely life or be married to someone she didn't love. She would not stand in the way of love, and they can be reunited. And just as she's coming to this realization, who is heard in the distance but the entire regiment, who marches back on stage, determined to save their little Marie, with Tonio at the helm. Tonio by now is a lieutenant. When he had to leave as an enlisted man, he didn't care if he lived or died, and the director said he threw himself into the battles in a suicidal manner, with the result that he's been promoted to a lieutenant. So now it's quite appropriate that he could marry the daughter of Marquesa. So it all comes out.
And so the Marquesa says, just because I lost my true love doesn't mean that my new reunited found daughter also has to lose her true love.
Yeah.
Go get married, be happy.
That's
end.
Really a rather sweet and special moment in this opera that this director chooses to bring out. This is a good example of how different directors approach these pieces. Instead of just caricaturing the Marquesa, which is easy to do and which is what often happens, he's looking a little deeper. She is 40, she is lonely, and Sulpice somehow is not off fighting these battles. He's in the chateau. That raises a few questions. So the two of them clearly are drawn to each other. So there are two love stories here. The love story of Marie Antonio, the young first loves, and then maybe the more mature relationship of the Marquesa with Sulpice that's implied in this particular production. It's very sweet. So the next little piece I'd like to play for you is where Marie, Tonio, and Sulpice are reunited and they realize that it's probably all going to work out in the end.
Parlerà pour moi. Parlerà pour lui. Pour moi. Pour lui. Parlerà pour moi. Mais non, pour la même. Tous les doigts. Tous les doigts. Mais c'est très bon. Il pense à ses promesses. Mais vous ne savez pas. Écoutez-moi, écoutez-moi.
Puisque j'ai sa tendresse.
Et puisque j'ai sa foi.
Puisque j'ai son amour.
Écoutez-moi, écoutez-moi.
So once again, everybody is happy, and the opera is almost over, and we're going to hear one more little piece from the opera.
Yeah,
right?
I can't resist playing you this, because again, it's Pavarotti, it's Tonio expressing how happy he is, and we will have this wonderful experience for something like 10 performances here this summer. So don't miss The Daughter of the Regiment at the Santa Fe Opera with Alex Schrader singing this role.
The piece that they did last year by Donizetti was called Don Pasquale. Mm. And I have to say that the way that was staged was one of the most creative things I've ever seen. I don't know how it's going to look this year because I haven't seen it yet. But the thing that was so great last year was Don Pasquale was a man and he married somebody and his life was turned upside down. And in the second act, the actual stage set was turned upside down.
That's right.
The chairs were on the ceiling. And I'm like, you know, these are some of the most
creative people
in the world.
Yeah, the Santa Fe Opera brings in the most creative people. And they're able to experiment and given pretty much a free hand to do what they want. With this particular director, Ned Canty, he did Our Last Savage. And if you remember what a riot that was.
That was great, too.
It's the same director. So we'll have a touch of that humor. And the same leading lady from The Last Savage, Anna Christie, who was so great in that little piece in her little safari suit singing all these bel cantos, she is going to be Marie in this production. So let's hear a last piece from The Daughter of the Regiment, Acitel, Tonio by Pavarotti.
The Daughter of the Regiment is over. The curtain comes down. And here we are at the Santa Fe Opera, where, by the way, if people are interested, they can go on backstage tours.
There's all sorts of ways of getting involved with the opera over and beyond going to performance. And I really encourage people to do that because we have one of the most innovative, unusual, beautiful theaters on earth. And the ways to do that are the backstage tours. If you've never done that, do this, especially this year, now that the new renovations are in place. You'll be amazed at the changes that have happened. Backstage tours happen every day, Monday to Friday, at 9 o'clock at the box office. There's a nominal charge, nothing to worry about, and you pay when you get there. You don't need to make a reservation. You could also go to Opera Insider Days. These are free events that run on Saturdays. The tours start at the box office, and an opera inside a day begins with coffee and muffins, and then there's a talk about 8:45. You need to meet at 8:30. About 8:45, there's a talk by one of the artists or one of the production people from an opera insider, and this event concludes then with the backstage tour. So that's fun to do. If you want to know what's going on in the rest of the grounds, you could take a ranch tour. There's a few of these. You'd need to call the box office to make a reservation for this. Again, it's a nominal charge. And this is an extended tour of the grounds known as the Opera Ranch with a Meet the Artist Composer. So whichever artist is strolling the grounds that afternoon, they nab and will talk to you. So these are some ways of getting involved with seeing the opera site itself, which is quite spectacular.
Now, you mentioned a moment ago that there's been a great deal of remodeling. Tell us about that.
Yes, the remodeling is something quite spectacular that the general director, Charles McKay, announced recently, Setting the Stage, it's called. It's been a campaign that's costing $35 million. That's phenomenal. And of that, $31 million has already been raised. That in and of itself is quite extraordinary. So what's happening? What are they doing with all this money? Well, it's been done in two stages. Most is completed. As you go into the theater, the box office is completely new. There is an expanded gift shop. The gift shop was always a little small, and anybody who experienced that knew it was like being a sardine in a sardine can. It was very hard, and everybody flocked there on cold nights. Now there's a very beautiful gift shop run by Jacqueline Abundis, who is an artist in and of herself. She does a beautiful job with the shop, where, of course, you can find my book, Opera Unveiled, and John Crosby's great new book, Vision of Voices.
By Craig Smith.
By Craig Smith, which you did a show fairly recently on Mary Shard. Also, on the front there, you'll see a dining terrace. They're going to have open-air little tables, patio seating, and you can buy box meals if you choose not to eat out of the back of your car, the way many people do tailgating. You can get food there. The main changes, however, have been backstage. If you ever stood backstage waiting with the chorus and everybody to go on and take a final call in the wings for the end of an opera, you know how impossible it's been. The wing space is tiny. It's been vastly expanded now. There is a new elevator to bring scenery up and down. The dressing rooms, which have not been changed since 1968, if you can believe that. I mean, it used to look like summer camp dressing rooms. And we've had the biggest stars on earth sing at the Santa Fe Opera, sharing showers. I mean, it's been crazy. These have been completely redone. They're quite beautiful. There's expanded space now for props, for costume scenery. Things like dyeing the costumes, working them, making them look antiqued, washing the costumes, ironing them, painting them, cleaning. All of this has now got new space. There are fitting rooms that didn't exist before. There are also lovely small warm-up rooms that singers can sing in that are completely soundproofed. And there is a conductor's room right by the stage. And in that conductor's room, there is a mirror that was given to John Crosby by his mother for his conductor's room at the opera.
All at the Santa Fe Opera. Desiree Mays, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte.
And before we go, I wanted to talk about one or two things that are coming up. You will be talking about your book, Opera Unveiled, in Albuquerque at Page One Bookstore on the 18th of June at 6 in the evening.
Yes, so anyway, it's free, open to the public. I'll do a little overview of the season so people can get an idea of which of the five operas, preferably all five, that they might like to go and see. There's also a program coming up on June the 20th from 9:30 to 11:30. This is for little people, for children age 3 to 5. It's going to be held at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum on Johnson Street in Santa Fe. Opera Makes Sense. And this is a little program that proves it's never too early to expose kids to opera and music, the sort of self-directed games and activities that use all of the five senses to explore opera. And each session focuses on one of the season's upcoming productions. So this is free. It's June 20th, 9:30 to 11:30 at the Georgia O'Keeffe.
And that's a Saturday morning, and the one in Page One Bookstore is a Thursday evening at 6 in the evening. Now, do the kids get to sing along?
Of course. Absolutely.
Well, Desiree Mays, it's just, as always, great to have you and to be talking about the Santa Fe Opera here on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
We've been talking to Desiree Mays, international opera lecturer and storyteller, and author of the book Opera Unveiled. She speaks every night at the Preview Buffet of the Opera. The Santa Fe Opera is on the web at santafeopera.org, and the phone number is 800-280-4654. The local number here in New Mexico is 505-986-5900.